I'm Mike Collins. Once the dust settles on the voting in Iowa and New Hampshire, the Democratic race for president heads south.
Make no doubt about it, the road to the White House starts in South Carolina.
The first in the South primary has been pivotal in picking Democratic nominees. Will that be the case this year? Join Charlotte Talks for a preview of the upcoming vote. We'll be at Winthrop University's DiGiorgio Campus Center Wednesday, February 12th at 7 p.m. Register to attend and find more information at wfae.org/charlottetalks. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, committed to Mazda's focus to ensure every element of a car is designed around the driver. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. On the local news roundup, teachers have been waiting for the state budget stalemate to end so they could get the promised raises, but CMS short-circuits the wait with raises of its own. Finally, movement on what to do with the old Eastland Mall site. Petitions for rezoning are filed in advance of Major League Soccer moving in. Mecklenburg County DA Spencer Merriweather lays out his priorities for 2020 that include a crackdown on violent crime, and Gaston County joins Catawba, Cabarrus, and I believe 17 other North Carolina counties and declares itself a Second Amendment sanctuary. Our roundtable of reporters is ready to detail those and other stories, and seated around this table are Ann Doss Helms from WFAE News. Good morning to you.
Good to be back.
Jonathan Lowe is here. He's reporter anchor for Spectrum News. Good morning.
Good morning, Mike.
Glenn Berkins is editor-publisher of QCityMetro.com. Welcome back.
Thank you.
And Eric Spanberg is managing editor of the Charlotte Business Journal. Good to see you.
Good morning, Mike.
You're wearing a tie and everything. If you're watching us on Facebook Live, you know that's a lie.
Not really.
So let's start with some good news for a change, at least for teachers. CMS is giving them a raise. It's all part of a CMS process that they've been undertaking for about 6 months to piece together a budget, literally piece by piece.
At this point, we're just basically putting a bow on our final budget, but we did want to bring closure to it so that we can start on our next budget.
So that's Sheila Shirley. She is the system's chief financial officer. Have they been doing this because the budget in Raleigh has literally been in stalemate?
Yes, and that's why if your listeners are thinking, well, I've heard this before, a lot, for a long time.
Yeah.
Yes, they've... Ideally, the way that works, CMS starts talking publicly about a budget in the spring, in this case, spring of last year, and the county then approves its portion. They always get that done by early June for a July 1st budget, so they know what they're getting there. Sometimes the state meets that deadline, and sometimes it's just a little bit after. In fact, until this year, it was always, you remember that year when they didn't approve a budget until October? And that was like the bad example. Now it's going to be, remember that year when they didn't approve a budget?
At all?
Period. So the CMS actually cleared the raises such as they are in November because the state said, well, we will at least pay for the step raises. And that's the experience-based raises where if you are anywhere in your first 15 years on the bachelor's scale, you get another $1,000 a year under the state scale. But the thing is, once you hit that 16th year, there's nothing for another 10 years. So for anybody who's in that highly experienced range, nothing under that. So CMS got, I think, $8 million from the county to boost the local supplement. They worked that in. So at minimum, you're going to get 1%. Some are as high as 8%. Average is 3%. But even though they voted for that in November, I think there was that uncertainty when the General Assembly came back in January. Were they going to override the governor's veto? Was there going to be any change? So I think at this point they said, no, that didn't happen. And, you know, the legislators actually approved a mini budget. They've been doing all these little chunks and pieces. And they actually approved one that had teacher raises. And Governor Cooper vetoed it, saying these raises are not adequate. So, in fact, they've gotten nothing but the step raises from the state, a little more from the county.
So that's a lot of information. Help me understand who's getting what, because it ranges from 1% raise to an 8% raise and averages out to 3%. So who gets what? Is it based on seniority? Is it based on education level? What's it based on?
Both. You have a pay scale that you fall on based on, and it's a combination of there's one pay scale if you only have a bachelor's degree, and then that goes up through 25 years. You know, I guess at 25 years you kind of cap out.
Right.
If you have board certification, it's much higher. If you have a master's degree, it's somewhat higher.
But it's not just teachers who are getting some of these raises, is that correct? It's going to some other folks, staff?
Well, there are others who are on the teacher pay scale, counselors, people like that.
Okay.
The principals are on a totally different pay scale, and their raises averaged better. The state actually approved got the governor's signature on a principal pay scale. And then the non-certified, the hourly people are getting, I think, an average of 3% also, and they've brought the minimum up to $13 and I think 22 cents, a little over $13. They haven't hit the $15 mark.
So if you get an 8% raise, what is that on average? Where does that put you?
I do not know. I have not seen a good breakdown from CMS, and I started asking for this a long time ago. But again, they were saying we aren't going to release pay scales when we don't know for sure what we've got.
So in reading about all this yesterday, here's where I really got confused, because the vote came at a time I understand that the teachers were scheduled to get back pay. Is that correct?
Yes, and that was just the time that it took it to work through the system. It's kind of a coincidence that the budget vote came on the week that they get their back pay.
So that back pay goes back to July 1st of...
Yes, and it's just the raise of 2018.
Whoa. Really?
I'm sorry, 2019.
2019. Yeah, we're in 2020 now.
Yeah. not making that mental adjustment. It's basically 6 months of... And they've already gotten their pay. This is the retroactive additional pay that they got with the raises.
And this money, the raise that they approved, is coming from the county? Is that where it's coming from, the money that...
The county, and or the step raise, if they qualified for a step raise.
I'm glad you understand all this.
Okay. It's confusing.
The old Eastland Mall site, which we all know has been sitting, I thought it had been sitting vacant for like 35 years. But no,
it feels like it's
the early 2000s. But we've been talking about this forever, and they've been trying to find a productive use for this. Enter Major League Soccer. They want to make it their headquarters. And this week, the City of Charlotte and Crossland Southeast, a developer, filed a rezoning petition for that purpose. The city's economic development director, Tracy Dodson, says she's excited about the possibilities of how this property might be used.
It's one more step forward, and it's really exciting that something that the community has wanted for so long in the city as well is finally starting to make its way to reality.
So David Tepper's MLS team wants to put their headquarters on a practice field and more there. Why is the city involved in filing a rezoning petition? They're filing a petition to themselves to rezone the property?
In part. That's bizarre. Well, remember, the city owns this land.
Yeah, but why are they filing a petition? Who are they petitioning? Themselves?
In essence, yes. So remember speaking of 35 years or longer, Eastland Mall opened in 1975.
Okay.
So this land has not been rezoned since the mall was built.
Okay.
And obviously they want to do transit and offices and townhomes and apartments and restaurants and shops and all those things. And so this is the first formal step to allow that. It will go through the typical hearing process. And at the end of it, probably in May or June, the city council will be asked to vote. I'm sure the city council will want to vote, as you say, for what they want.
And this mythical $110 million.
Not mythical.
Well, it's floating out
undecided.
There, undecided. And so far, untalked about, if that's a word, with the public, which is the law. This $110 million, is that where some of that money is scheduled to go?
That is where some of that money will go. But you are correct in implying or stating that the city is quite reluctant to say how much of that money will go to Eastland. And it's interesting, Mike, that the city has tied all this to the entertainment district uptown that David Tepper wants to do, as well as the future of the stadium. So what I think is going to be really interesting is Eastland's going to move faster than those two things, those other two items likely. So how do they sort that out and say, okay, we feel comfortable enough to go ahead and award you the money for the Eastland piece, even though these other things haven't happened yet?
So in order to spend this money and to decide how much money they want to spend on this, they have to have a public meeting. Have they had that meeting yet?
Not so much.
Maybe I missed it. You know, I was on vacation.
You know what they have done, Mike? The mayor has written a letter to the commissioner of Major League Soccer in November stating that money will be part of the package to bring a team here. So I would say that it's very likely the money will be spent, but we just haven't. Let's say we've done this in reverse order. That's what would be a good way to put it.
Yeah, well, yes. And yeah. So we put our neck on the line, and the guillotine better not drop. There has been some...
eloquently put.
Thank you. There's been some concern about just how transparent the city is being with all these dealings surrounding soccer. Clear the city wants the soccer team. There's no question. It appeared that the money was promised, as you just said, prior to any public meeting on this. And the announcement of the rezoning is not without a similar controversy, it seems, because some of the city's news outlets were apparently not invited to cover the announcement of the rezoning. WCCB-TV was among the outlets left out, and they spoke with City Councilman Braxton Winston about it.
Whether this is intentional or not, this erodes trust, and we have to work to get that trust back and push it forward. So this is not a good thing.
So who else was left off that list? Jonathan?
So I was.
Yeah.
And, you know, I figured this was going to come up. So, the way that I want to preface this by saying, you know, this is not about, I think the way that it was maybe perceived by some on social media and in the moments and hours after, that this was some sort of like ego thing, like we deserve to be there. But people need to remember a couple of things, I think. With Eastland, the media has been, and it's all forms of media, it wasn't just my station that wasn't invited, because this was a situation where the city reached out to certain people, mm-hmm. And invited them to this rezoning briefing and then this media availability with Tracy Dotson, the sound you just played there. But Eastland has been, as you mentioned, something that has gone on for years. And I can only speak for my station in particular. There have been several reporters prior to me that have covered Kirsten Garris, who used to have on your show regularly, mm-hmm. before that, Brad Broders, covered the ins and outs, the different administrations, all that has gone on with Eastland. And so if you are hand-picking stations and you say to me, because I had a conversation with a spokeswoman, that they chose stations to preview this with, it did not make sense that you would not invite everyone on such a significant topic.
In fact, someone by the name of you tweeted, this is not cool. Charlotte cherry-picked stations to invite to embargoed briefing and interview. Embargo, for those who are not in the news business, means you can come, but you can't publish the story until the specific date and time.
But it was that day.
But it was that day. So how is this appropriate for a public entity, you asked? Was this an oversight? Was it intentional? Did they think they were just bringing people that they thought would be favorable or who understood the history of this better than perhaps other outlets did, because they've been covering it in other outlets?
Again, that brings me back to my original point. I mean,
and why would they want to only selectively invite a couple of?
I don't know. All I can say is that a handful of the people who were not invited have a proven history of covering not just what has gone on with Eastland, but also this $110 million in hospitality funds. People have been on our air and on other forms of media saying that they want this done in the public eye. They want the opportunity for the public to speak out. And so how else are they going to be informed if, you know, that was a large swath of people who were not part of that briefing.
Did they do some kind of public press conference or announcement after the embargoed briefings?
My understanding is that there was a media availability with several media, and I don't know, Eric, you were there. There
was actually our real estate reporter was there.
Oh, okay.
I was not at that one.
Oh, okay. So, sorry, the Business Journal was there.
Yes.
There was a media availability with Tracy Dotson where all of them got to interview her after this rezoning petition was filed.
Glenn. I want to come to Jonathan's defense. Not that he needs defending. This was a horrible idea. Government organizations should not play favorite with media. We're seeing that in Washington. I would love to see someone in city government say unequivocally that this will not be done again. The media landscape is changing, and nowhere is it changing more than here in Charlotte. We're seeing the beginnings of grassroots media organizations, and we all have our constituencies. Mm-hmm. And it should not be up to elected officials to decide which constituencies they want to speak to.
Glenn Berkins is the editor and publisher of QCityMetro.com, one of the expanding media outlets, although you've been around for a while now.
11 years.
In Charlotte. Eric Spanberg is managing editor of the Charlotte Business Journal. Jonathan Lowe is a reporter anchor with Spectrum News, and Andos Helms is from our newsroom. We're coming right back at Charlotte Talks. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, committed to drivers that share Mazda's passion that cars make driving matter. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's the local news roundup on Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins with Ann Doss Helms, Jonathan Lowe, Eric Spanberg, and Glenn Birkins. Britt Baldick from Fox 46 wrote this about the Eastland briefing, to which some media outlets were not invited. He said, quote, "You invite all media to events. Don't cherry pick. It's up to journalists how to tell a story, not the government. That's called state-run media." And you had a conversation, Jonathan, with somebody at the city after this, in which they made some, I don't know whether they were inadvertent or amateur or deliberate, but troubling comments.
Well, so this all played out. I found out about the briefing, tried several times while I'm at the retreat, mind you, called and finally got through to this person and was told a couple things. One, that direct quote, you all choose the stories you want to cover, so we felt like we would choose who we wanted at this briefing.
Wow.
Furthermore, I was told that there was so much that happened. The point you brought up in the break, help me, Glenn, about what I was told. I can't even remember.
Right.
I was.
Go ahead.
Gosh, I'm losing my train of thought.
It's all right.
Well, yeah, I mean, it is. We were saying if
let me go
it's
back
one thing if two people have called to ask about something, they got wind of it, and you say, come on in. But if you're just announcing something, and this doesn't seem like something particularly controversial, that's the part that seems weird. They essentially made themselves controversial,
yes,
by doing it this way, which is always the risk when you play
favorites. But what's troubling
that
is that the language being used here and the fact that they did this is indicative of a mindset, I think, that is troubling and antithetical to democracy.
Someone online called it an unforced error.
Oh,
and
yeah,
that's exactly
the other
what it
thing
was.
I remembered. I had to go back to my tweet because it was like so much that they said that they would consider, and this is also a direct quote, they would consider us in the future.
And
consider us in the future,
mm-hmm,
to
nice
cover these kinds of things. So, you know, that was all in the course of that phone call. But I did, after I tweeted that out, I did get another phone call from, you know, the head of communications, just apologizing and let me know that it was inadvertent, and that was the word, and it was an oversight. Their statement that they put out had my name in it only, and another media here then called them out and said it wasn't just me that was, you know, an oversight of just me. It was an oversight of several media outlets. So, you know, the question of was this intentional, I don't know. It just didn't make sense to me with something so significant that clearly my station and others have covered for years, 4 years.
Were you invited, Eric?
Actually, I said our real estate reporter,
okay,
covered it. But it is, you know, it's interesting because embargo briefings can be very helpful, I think, you know, with a complicated topic. But it's very simple. You just invite everybody, and whoever wants to show up shows up. I think that's the easy way to fix this.
Yeah, and I was told that, you know, these are people, the people who were invited were people that have covered this for years. And I'm like, well, we have two, but I
yeah,
was just,
absolutely. I mean,
I was just at the retreat.
You're at the government center all the time.
I went,
retreats.
Right, and I went to the retreat, which Eric was there, you know, the three-day retreat, which was just about 3 weeks ago that the city had up in Durham, where we talked about MLS. And several city council members said that this was going to be a transparent process. And that's all that I'm focused on, because there are a lot of us that are invested in the well-being of the city, and that's why I tweeted it out.
Glenn's,
I really
story. It's
Glenn's
a big story.
Point about the changing media scene is so important, I think, and for them to keep up with that, because I can remember when really the only way you were going to get a complicated story out to the public was in the Charlotte Observer, and people would come to the Charlotte Observer and make pre-presentations on a budget or something that was going to require a lot of numbers and, again, you know, less internet access. But that's not the world we're in now. It's, you know, there are new players who are trying hard to establish themselves, and if you cut them out, like Glenn said, you're not only sending that message to the individuals, but to their listeners, readers, whatever.
And I can see that you might, in an oversight, not invite Charlotte Agenda or something else like that. But Spectrum News has been around forever, and you turn the on button on if you're a Spectrum customer, and there they are.
And my management has, it's been for years also, they have had people dedicated to covering city county government. Like
I was
going to
say,
I can't go
to the government center without seeing this guy. So he's always
that
there.
Is saved to you, but you know, I think it's important to. And my last point on this is that, as Glenn mentioned, and I appreciate his comment. It's just his comment is representative of a lot of the comments that tweet got. All of the media that clearly, you know, we're all very competitive, but we all support when we see someone who is really fighting for just transparency and honesty, right. And, you know, being genuine, I really appreciate just seeing how many people here support that. So,
and by the way, they did not forget Charlotte Agenda. They were at that meeting. I just want to point that out. All right. Mecklenburg County District Attorney Spencer Merriweather outlined his office's priorities for 2020 after a year with a record high murder count. He plans a sweeping crackdown against violent crime. How is he proposing to do that, Glenn?
He took about 45 minutes laying out his priorities for this year and answering media questions. Several things. Basically, he wants to make his office more efficient. That's one of the things. But also, he wants to lobby state legislators on some important issues. One of the key things he wants to do is bring more cases to trial involving homicides and guns. I think he said that he wants to bring to trial 20 cases in the new year.
This was surprising to me. There were 13 cases that they brought to trial. 13 in 2019 in the year we had 107 homicides. And they want to raise the number next year or this year to 20.
And I think they said 75 are awaiting trial just on homicide. That's not other violent gun charges.
Why does it take so long? I thought we had speedy trial laws in America.
Well, I don't know why it takes so long. I guess that's a question better asked of the DA. But I think a lot of people would be surprised that so few cases actually do reach trial. But most cases are.
Is that because they're pled out?
Yeah, they're pled out. Our courts would be clogged if every case actually went to trial. So one of the things he wants to do is to increase the number of homicide and gun cases that actually do go to trial. And he's going to do that primarily by asking his assistant DAs to take on more work, to work a little harder. Okay. One other important thing that he wants to ask of state lawmakers, currently, unlike the federal government, in the federal system, if a judge deems that a defendant is a danger to the community, they don't have to offer bail to that defendant. They can hold that person without bail. That's not true in North Carolina, except in the case of murder and
first degree murder.
First degree murder
is the only stipulation.
So what judges have been doing in the cases of individuals who they deem might be dangerous to the community, they've been trying to set bail at such a high level that the defendant might not be able to meet that bail requirement. And that's a gamble. You never know when someone can meet it or can't meet it. So what DA Merriweather said he wants to do is begin lobbying the state legislature for the right for state judges to also hold defendants deemed dangerous to the community without bail.
Are they likely to do that? He's a Democratic DA in a Democratic county, and the Republican legislature is not only Republican, but it's rural in nature, and we're an urban county. Are they likely to respond to him positively?
I don't know about that. It's a proposal that I would think a conservative state could get behind. As I asked DA Merriweather, I think there's a danger in that. Our court systems are not colorblind. They're not blind to economics. And one of the dangers of this is that we could see judges holding people from certain communities without bail more than others. I asked him about that. He says he has confidence that that will not happen.
I thought, Mike, along those lines, I thought it was also interesting that he made some comments, Glenn, along the lines of wanting the state to think about equity in terms of funding courts in a different way and the needs of urban communities. And I suspect he's right. I also suspect that'll be a very difficult case to make to the Republican legislature.
He also talked about at his press conference judges. He wants to streamline or accelerate the handoff of cases from police to prosecutors, and by persuading district court judges to handle more low-level felonies, which they, he says, have resisted up to now. Why have they resisted? Does anybody know? Okay, Mary.
I believe it's a workload issue. I think they've resisted just because of the workload.
Because he says the judge's opposition does, quote, self-inflicted harm to an already under-resourced criminal justice system. He also outlined some ideas for a different way for his department to approach violent crime. He wants to pursue community prosecutions, something he says is similar to community policing.
Something as simple as one day actually having prosecutors in offices and neighborhoods. It could mean mobile units. It could mean office hours in a church basement.
Did he say how this would work? I mean, is he putting prosecutors and judges in church basements on Friday nights and having court? What's he doing?
No, I don't think he's having court. I think he's having them move around the city so that people can get to them easier to present evidence and things that are going on in that specific area.
If you're a victim, if you're the family of a victim, if you have information that might be pertinent to a case, there might be people in your community, so you don't have to get in a car or a bus or whatever and go downtown.
And it sounds like the basic idea is building trust, building relationships, right. That this is not some remote office full of scary people downtown. This is somebody I've met in my church.
Hence the analogy to community policing. It's the same principle. So speaking of police, CMPD has invited the SBI, the State Bureau of Investigation, to come in to investigate the death of a suspect while in CMPD's custody. What else do we know about that?
Well, the suspect did not actually die in CMPD custody. Okay. On January 23rd, officers observed what they had reason to believe, or they said they had reason to believe, was a drug transaction. They arrested a man named Harold Easter. At some point during his arrest and processing at the Metro Division, he had what CMPD has described as a, quote, life-threatening medical emergency, end quote. The officers who were there administered first aid, called medic. 3 days later, Mr. Easter died at a hospital. CMPD has not really described what that medical emergency was, or it was. We don't know anything about it. So yesterday, the department announced that after consulting with the DA, after meeting with Mr. Easter's family, they have asked the State Bureau of Investigation to look at the case.
How unusual is that?
I don't think it's terribly unusual, especially if a family requests it. I don't know exactly what
CMPD has a new policy, and it started late last year, where and this, to my knowledge, involves police shootings. I don't know if it's just wide range. Anytime there's a serious injury, I think it may be serious injury or death, but the SBI will automatically investigate shootings.
Yeah, remember,
right?
That was a big shift.
Right.
That was a big shift.
Because CMPD was investigating itself, but now the SBI. So them calling SBI in, I think, with the circumstances of Mr. Easter dying while he was, having that medical emergency while he was in custody, was a little bit different from police shooting.
A weak thing we would point out is that five officers in the Metro Division were placed on administrative leave, which is standard procedure when there is an in-custody.
And when we know something about one of those officers, people probably remember Officer Brantley Vinson. He's one of the officers that was suspended as part of this current investigation, but people probably remember him. He is the officer who shot and killed Keith Lamont Scott in 2016.
So a week or so ago, Charlotte City Council held their retreat, their annual retreat in Durham, and not to be outdone, Mecklenburg County Commissioners had a week of it. They held their retreat at CPCC. in advance of that, and as a way to help them formulate their budget, they spent the last few months asking citizens what matters most to them. What did they discover, Jonathan?
So it's interesting. Education, I mean, the results of that budget priority survey were that they, that was one of the things that they handled yesterday on day two. The overall priority across all districts was education. But what, as far as what people think is the most underfunded, mm-hmm. was mental health. The budget priority survey, as people know, was something they started last year, the second year. They had about 1,600, I believe, people the first year. They had just over 3,000 completed this year.
Why the greater number, do you think?
I think there was more, honestly, it was a lot more marketing. They got the information out there in a lot of different mediums.
You are the king of tweets on this panel today, because you tweeted out that education was rated top overall priority among all six Mecklenburg County districts. Affordable housing and health and human services came out almost even. They kind of split second and third place, depending mm-hmm. upon what you were looking at. And environment mm-hmm. was soundly at number four. Then came economic development, surprisingly enough, criminal justice, parks and recreation. Channel 9 reported that the top two issues for citizens were Mecklenburg Pre-K mm-hmm. and the arts. They're not even show up in your report.
Was that for citizens, or was that something that the county commissioners were saying was a priority
maybe
to discuss?
Maybe I misread it. Could be. Maybe I misread it. I don't know.
Yeah, I think.
Okay.
I think
certainly
that
two things that were on the agenda.
Yeah,
right. I think that may have been referring to what they covered
okay.
yesterday.
Well, they did talk about the arts.
They did.
At the retreat. The sales tax referendum that would have funded the Arts and Science Council went down to a resounding defeat by voters. They're looking at pretty dark days. Eric, you tweeted earlier this month that ASC President Jeep Bryant told you and other reporters, if they don't find an additional $5 million by June, dark days are ahead. Did he get into the particulars?
So what he said at that time was that they could cut the grants that they give to local arts groups by up to 50%. There are all kinds of caveats with this. In other words, you know, what if they raise $1 million or $1.5 million or whatever? So that it's kind of a sliding scale. But the essence of it is, Mike, that ASC is going to the city, the county, and the corporate community and saying, okay, how can you help us? We tried this tax. It obviously failed. We need help.
So at the retreat, County Commissioner Pat Cotham said she would like to see increased funding for the Arts and Science Council. But Vilma Leek says the ASC is made up, and I quote here, of elitists, and mm-hmm. questioned why she should support them when people in her district don't benefit from it.
And the counterpoint that a lot of arts supporters would make is that by providing public funding, you can take it to people who are not elitists. You can take vital arts to the poor.
I have an answer for you on the other side.
Okay. There is another side, because we're about to fall off the cliff here. We're coming right back with more of the News Roundup on WFAE. Music up. It's Charlotte Talks and the local news roundup on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. And Doss Helms is here from our newsroom. Glenn Birkins is with us from QCityMetro.com. Eric Spanberg is managing editor of the Charlotte Business Journal. And Jonathan Lowe is reporter anchor for Spectrum News. We were talking about the discussions at the County Commission retreat this week, among them the Arts and Science Council and the need for funding the arts. Pat Cotham on one side saying she'd like to see more money, maybe perhaps more specificity.
Yes.
But also on the other side, Vilma Leek saying the ASC is made up of elitists and why should she support them? Who had the greater support on commission? Do we know?
I don't know if there is the broad support that they had last year. I think Elaine Powell, who was vice chair, she was very clear and to the point that her district, District 1, which is a lot of North Mecklenburg, voted 63% against that referendum back in November that would have been that quarter-cent sales tax hike. She said she just cannot see them working this into the next budget because there just is not the broad support in her district. So, you know, Vilma Leek is against it. Elaine Powell, Pat Cotham's kind of on the fence. And then you have Susan Harden, who was the main supporter and backer behind that campaign, the Parks, Arts, and Education.
Right.
She made the speech, but she's not running for re-election. So
both Glenn and Eric.
Go ahead, Glenn.
In the interest of full disclosure, I'll say up front that the Arts and Science Council is an advertiser on Q City Metro, has been for years. But I guess I would kind of challenge or give a little pushback to the notion that their work is all about elitists. Yes, much of their money might go to support major institutions downtown, but they're not advertising with Q City Metro to reach the downtown crowd. There are countless programs in...
And I spoke to Jeep Bryant this week about this, and I said, what happens if you don't get this money? Because before the vote, the referendum, you painted this really dark picture of what was going to happen. What specifically will happen? And he says, I said, is the symphony going to stop playing? Is the ballet company going to be done? He said, no, this is going to be the small things like outreach and funding for individual artists, the very things that are not elitist, I guess, because they're going out into the community. That's what we'll suffer.
There's one coming up next month, Connect with Culture Days. Many of those activities, free family activities that involve the arts, many of those activities will be in underserved communities.
And recreation.
I wanted to mention two things. One is on Commissioner Leak specifically, someone from the ASC had told me in response that they have invested $388,000 in the last 2 years in her district. And that's apart from the culture blocks that are specifically designated to various areas. So they feel like they've more than contributed to, equity and outreach. But the second thing is on the broader idea of funding. I think it's interesting. The county manager is definitely in favor of doing something. You could see that she was very eager to find a way to do this. So I don't think this is going to die easily or quickly.
But it is important to note that on February 11th, there is a budget policy meeting, and there are only two things on the agenda. One is something kind of murky about transportation. The other thing is a presentation from the Arts and Sciences Council. So it will be interesting to see, as the county budget process is ramping up, how the county manager takes into account the presentation from the Arts and Science Council versus what she heard from the commissioners and will hear over the coming weeks about this topic.
So another topic the county leaders talked about was their response in the face of a crisis developing during the RNC. They wanted to get a preview of how they might act. CMPD Chief Kerputney seems pretty confident that there won't be any problems, but better safe than sorry, I suppose. What would be the county's part in responding to any crisis? Did they make a decision on that?
So the commissioners got a kind of a watered-down training called Crisis Management and Enterprise Risk Management. And it's basically the county manager said, this has not really been triggered by RNC, but since that is the first major event coming up, that they can apply this new training. But it basically sets an organized process of responding to different crisis scenarios. So that could be an IT hack, that could be an act of terrorism, civic unrest, some sort of, any sort of crisis that you could think of. There was a whole, list of them.
And in this retreat, the county also officially, I think, got on the same page with CMPD and the city of Charlotte when it comes to characterizing the 2019 homicide count. County Public Health Director Gibby Harris told commissioners, this constitutes a public health crisis. Her department presented what has been described in some publications as a hastily drawn up a community violence prevention plan, which apparently, because of its hastiness, got some scrutiny from commissioners. What did they object to?
Well, they just don't think it's comprehensive enough. They think it's half-baked, in essence. And even as the county said, look, we had to do this in a hurry, some of the commissioners were not very forgiving. And I think there's just a sense of frustration that this is not moving fast enough, not just with county commissioners, but I think across the board you're hearing that again and again.
Yeah, it didn't really – there was no – with this declaration of it being a public health crisis, there was no real clear – specificity on solutions and prevention and suppression.
I think it's a good thing that they're starting to look at this as a public health crisis. But it's also, I think they need to look at it from an economic standpoint, too. One of the safest or one of the surest ways to reduce crime is to give people is to be sure people can get good paying jobs.
Right.
To that point, Glenn, the county commissioners really did delve into some hardcore topics that affect,
like, the food deserts.
Yes, the food desert. They talked about food deserts. We've talked about this on this program, that if you get to, on certain sides of town,
yes,
you cannot find
West Charlotte, East Charlotte,
a grocery store. Almost 15% of Mecklenburg County residents. This actually shocked me that the number's that high. 15% of Mecklenburg County residents live in an area that has little to no access to a supermarket.
Higher than right. The national and state averages. I there were a lot of people in that room that were shocked and very upset by it. And one of the things that I think is really interesting, particularly from a business standpoint, hearing them discuss this, is now the county is going to put on the table the idea of incentives
yep.
for grocery stores to locate in these underserved areas.
County manager and so, Dina DiOrio is going to invite them in, and
she's going to invite, on that point, executives of the major grocery stores she's going to try to set up a meeting.
Aren't they all from out of town, though?
Right. So the county staff, when I asked for more details on that, they were, you know, very honest and open that, you know, the logistics of that may be complicated, but that is the hope. So that, you know, and their business manager got up and said that he's looking into the state statutes on if they even have the authority to offer incentives for...
Although, Jonathan, retail. You remember there was that statement from the UNC School of Government in the packet that said probably this could fly in terms of low income and underserved. And also they had a number of examples from Baton Rouge, Birmingham, Louisville, other cities where various incentives programs have been put together to do this. So I think, I mean, I'm just guessing here, but I think that the county is going to really try to do something in this area.
Go ahead, Brian.
No, that's right.
What was clear from that the discussion, though, is that there are a number of organizations here in the community and Mecklenburg County that are trying to do what they can to provide healthier food options. The farmers market and their SNAP benefits, Lowe's and Fish's. We just had the other day where that mobile food market was going around the city. So clearly there's those organizations are out there, and so I think that's why the county is now looking at, you know, we've got these organizations, but we need more help from the business community.
And County Manager Dina DiOrio, at some point in all this, said, you know, you've asked for a lot of things, and you need funding yeah. for a lot of things. Do you know this is going to cost money? And I think the board chair said there's no appetite here for a property tax increase.
And that was very quick at the end.
Boy, he did not hesitate, did he?
I mean, it was like... No tax increase, adjourned.
Yeah. Others jumped in very quickly and said, yeah, I'm with him.
Okay. On Tuesday night, Gaston County joined Cabarrus, Alexander, Cleveland, Catawba, Lincoln, and Rowan counties, and I believe 13 other counties in the state, with a resolution of their own proclaiming themselves to be a Second Amendment sanctuary. The resolution promises not to pass or enforce any laws that might infringe on the rights of the people in Gaston County to bear arms, as promised in both the Second Amendment of the U.S. and the North Carolina Constitution. Republican Gaston County Commissioner Chad Brown was on this program on Wednesday. He was one of the three co-sponsors of that resolution, and he explained why the county pursued it in the first place.
The left has tried to infringe upon those rights, and that's one of the things the Constitution talks about, and it very explicitly states upon infringing on our rights. So that's one of the things that why you think about Gaston County, we started that for a reason, to make sure that those weren't infringed upon our people.
So that was passed unanimously by the Gaston County Commission. What's driving this, not just in Gaston County, but in there are votes coming up in other counties that surround Mecklenburg. What's driving this?
I think this
you
is
mentioned
just
the radical left, so the liberal left.
Yeah, I mean, I think this is just the overall left-right tension over gun rights, over...
But is it specific to things like the red flag laws that the governor has suggested?
Yes, I think it's absolutely stemming from that. And there has been a lot more momentum, I would say. There may not be tangible results, but there's been a lot more vocal outcry because of all of the shooting tragedies for more gun control. And I think that obviously gets the other side, active, and they certainly are in this case.
And this is a big election year.
I was going to say, ignore that.
Yes.
It's essentially a political statement of saying we're not going to do something unconstitutional, which
yay. You know, I guess we're not going
similar
to do anything
to
that violates
fight,
the Second
too.
Amendment.
I mean,
yeah.
So Gaston County Commission passed it, as I said, unanimously, but Gaston County Democratic Party Chairman Daniel Caudill issued a statement reading, "As municipal ordinances do not supersede state or federal law, it is curious to us as to why this specific subject is something our elected officials feel they need to work on. As a gun owner, I find this resolution unnecessary." And this has a lot of support. These resolutions have a lot of support in the legislature, the same legislature that does not support immigration sanctuary municipalities. And it's coming from Republicans. And on that same program on Wednesday that we had Chad Brown on, we had Christy Clark. She represents House District 98 in the House of Representatives here in North Carolina. And she's also a Democrat, and she expressed her point of view.
In general, these resolutions have no impact on the law and they have no meaning. And in general, they are political statements to help push forward an agenda that is to loosen gun laws in the state.
So how could they have no impact on the law if a county commission refuses to pass or enforce laws that they deem to be unconstitutional infringements on gun rights?
I don't think they necessarily have an impact on the law. What you might see and what we're seeing in some other states are local sheriffs, for example, saying that they're not going to enforce red flag laws. Mm-hmm. So while it won't necessarily change what's on the books, just as we've seen sheriffs here in North Carolina say they won't honor certain ICE voluntary detainers.
Nullification by sheriff's departments and county commissions is happening on a lot of different issues on both sides of the political fence.
That's what we're seeing.
Is there historic precedent for this, or is this a new phenomenon where people who we elect to pass and enforce laws refuse to do so?
I don't think we have to go back any farther than the civil rights era to see local sheriffs and police departments refusing to enforce local laws, which is one of the reasons the National Guard was brought in certain instances.
So does this mean I can park anywhere I want?
Well, and it's analogous to a reversal of the tension over the bathroom ordinance that we had a couple years ago, where you had state lawmakers saying, well, why in the world would you do this? We supersede you, so why do this?
Okay, Elizabeth Lane Elementary School, overcrowded. We've known they're overcrowded for a while. They're out of land. They can't put any more mobile classrooms up. CMS thought they had a solution, but not so fast. What happened on Tuesday night?
Well, what we're seeing, essentially, you may remember 2017, voters approved $922 million in school bonds. We're seeing some of these projects getting close to actually being built and opening. And so you do, in fact, have people saying, well, yes, we knew all along that the new Lansdowne is big and is going to take some of our students. It needs to be those other guys. So I don't think that anybody has shot down the idea of take carving off some of the zone. It's just showing that it's going to be very contentious as to who gets carved off.
And we heard a couple of weeks ago that North Carolina is changing the social studies curriculum to allow for financial education. And one of the things that they're now suggesting we cut is human evolution and prehistoric times. That may vanish from the curriculum. Some teachers are fighting to keep the Paleolithic era alive, because I was alive then, and I'm all for that. But evolution flies in the face of some religious groups. Is this a political choice, or is this something has to give? It might as well be this.
Yeah, and I was not able to ascertain this. There were long meetings that I'm sure most of us would have found tedious, in which educators and DPI officials talked about these standards. They were then published for review. These are not the final locked-in standards. This is exactly what's supposed to happen, as teachers look at this and say, you know, if you're starting with Neolithic, you've just carved off something pretty important here. So they are saying mid-February, there can still be more comments on this draft that's out there. And then they will come out with a second draft, and we'll see.
Now,
I couldn't find anybody to say why.
Can we teach the Scopes trial? I'm not sure.
I don't know. Just the monkeys around this table. So we know that Luke Kuechly is no longer a Panther, and I think yesterday it was announced that Greg Olson has decided, he and the team came to a decision that he would no longer be a Panther. So that's bad news. And the other bad news, I suppose, is that Charlotte is featured in a Super Bowl commercial this week that has some people ticked off because it shows us in the light of the demonstrations following the shooting of Keith Lamont Scott. How will there be repercussions for Budweiser from Charlotte for this? Or are we just too...
I'm going to go with Jonathan's answer.
Glenn Burke and Zarek Spencer.
I don't
Jonathan
drink Budweiser.
Lowell, and Doss Helms. Thank you all. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, dedicated to those who believe a car should stir one's emotions and deliver a heightened state of driving. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.